This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, Vanuatu offers to lend a hand to Australian farmers hit by the bushfire crisis.
There is a likelihood that if any farmers in Australia whose farm has been damaged by the bushfire is requesting that Vanuatu or any other Pacific Islanders would go and work on his farm for the reconstruction and rebuilding purposes, there are processes in place.
Also, why alarm bells are being rung about a black sand mining project in Fiji that its critics say has taken place without proper community input.
That is a critical area because that is a food table for this area.
We are hearing anecdotally that it is having an impact on, for example, local crab populations in the rivers where villagers fish for their own personal use but also to take to market.
And can the new coach of the PNG Hunters learn the culture of the rugby league team to help bring success this year?
Most rugby league teams invent their own language anyway, the way that they talk and they speak. It might be English or it might be pidgin and you can understand it but you have no idea what it means. So we'll write our own language and we'll get along well. We're bonding reasonably well. I'm pretty happy with how I'm getting along with the group.
We're going to hear more from Matt Church, the Australian who is now the new coach of the PNG Hunters, later in the program. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister says he wants the country's defence force to be strengthened so that it can carry out more international duties, including more peacekeeping deployments with the United Nations. Now, Prime Minister James Marape made the comments as he farewelled a contingent of 100 PNG Defence Force personnel who've now arrived in Australia to help with the bushfire recovery efforts here.
Our hands, our boots and our hearts will be on the ground in the affected areas to show our love for our fellow brethren and sisters in Australia who have over many, many years also in similar manner have shown love and compassion to us.
They'll be in Australia for 3 months, clearing roads and bridges in some of the areas that have been ravaged by the bushfires this summer. So far, more than 8 million hectares have been burnt. 27 people have died, as have tens of thousands of native animals, as well as agriculture livestock too. Now, 27-year-old Lieutenant Georgina Tebegetu is among those being deployed from PNG's Defence Force.
It is very challenging for me, but I think I will do my best, and I know that whatever that we'll do down in Australia, it will be very helpful to the people of Australia. So we are looking forward to do building sets and rescue to help civilians and other assets, ship vessel sets, and also we'll carry out a clearance on bushfire debris and other activities that will be tasked for us to do.
And James Marape says that this deployment should be the first of many such ones. Here he is speaking yesterday.
And so today, as I discharge you as your Prime Minister, it gives me great pleasure. This should be the start of many, many similar engagements. We look forward to building a defence force that is responsive also to the call of not only domestic duties but international duties. I look forward to one day you also serving as Papua New Guinean soldiers abroad, possibly in United Nations peacekeeping engagements and elsewhere.
That is the Prime Minister of PNG, James Marape. Now, it is not the first time that the idea of PNG being involved, at least in UN peacekeeping operations, has been raised. Some efforts have been made over the past decade, in fact, for PNG to have the legal framework required to make it happen. And in fact, a small number of officers were sent to join teams in Sudan and South Sudan in Africa back in 2012. Well, staying with the bushfires, and the woman responsible for Vanuatu's seasonal workers in Australia says that workers from her country stand ready to help those farmers who sustained extensive damage in the current bushfire crisis. Vanuatu's Labor Commissioner is Muriel Melton-Hoven, and she says that there are hundreds of Vanuatu workers in Australia at the moment and has confirmed that nearly 50 were evacuated earlier this month when a fire threatened the orchard where they work in the state of New South Wales. Among them was James Wallow, and he spoke with Pacific Beat last week about that experience. Let's take a listen.
I've never saw anything like this before. We experienced a bushfire back home in like my own island in Vanuatu, but never like this. This is just too dangerous for me. In Vanuatu, like just burn the bush, but not the house. Like in Australia, just like burn everything. And just want to say thank you because we are safe.
James Wallow, a worker here in Australia who was evacuated along with nearly 50 others last week. Now, they have managed to return to their work site near the small town of Batlow. Bushfires, though, do continue to burn around the country, and the threat that they pose in those other parts is certainly not over. Vanuatu's Labor Commissioner Muriel Meltenhoven, though, doesn't believe that at this stage the fires will have any major impact on the number of workers that are sent from Vanuatu to work on Australian farms for the rest of this year.
They assume that there are about 480 in Vanuatu that are currently affected by the bushfire in the areas of New South Wales and Victoria. But at the moment, the statistics that we've been collecting, there are about 100 that have been evacuated, and 48 of them have been contacting the High Commissioner in Australia, confirming that they are well and safe.
Well, that is good news, but as you say, if you've got around 100 who have been evacuated, what do you know about those who will be able to return and get back to normal with work, or for those who perhaps work on farms that have been either partially damaged or destroyed by these fires? Does that mean they have no more work and they have to head home?
At this point of time, there was no confirmation from the approved employer that these 100 or 48 or 480 are badly affected, which may result in the return back to Vanuatu. So at this point of time, there is no confirmation on that information. But what I understand from the 48, the farms that they have been working on is not really affected. So there is work provided that the fire goes down and they are able to be back to the farm and work for the reconstruction of the farm and also for the fruit picking.
Of course, though, here in Australia, we are only a small way into what is expected to be a long bushfire season. So it's quite likely that either workers in these locations or other locations not yet threatened by fire could be in coming weeks and months. Are you confident that you have the right measures in place with the farmers, the approved employers and the Australian government to make sure that Vanuatu workers are safe amid the bushfire threat?
Yes, because we are working closely with the Department of Employment and DFAT in Australia, now High Commission in Canberra. And the information I got from them last week was that all is under control and there are risk measures in place. And if there is any unusual situation, they will let us know. If our workers are not safe, then we will work together for the repatriation back to Vanuatu while the bushfire status is, you know, going down. And as I've already mentioned, we are happy to assist any farmers in Australia for the reconstruction or rebuilding of his farm after the damage caused by the bushfire.
And is that for farmers who are involved in the program currently, or do you think there is actually a possibility, an opportunity for Pacific seasonal workers to come and assist those other farmers who have been affected and devastated and help rebuild? Might this be a new element of the program that you think could be explored?
Yeah, there is a likelihood that if any farmers in Australia whose farm has been damaged by the bushfire is requesting that Vanuatu or any other Pacific Islanders would go and work on his farm for the reconstruction and rebuilding purposes, there are processes in place so they can go through the Department of Employment make arrangement with them to get their approval to come and recruit in Vanuatu.
The question will be, of course, who pays for that? Farmers obviously are going to be completely devastated as well. Perhaps it might be some sort of financial assistance provided by the Australian government. Is that something that you are having discussions already with your counterparts in Australia?
At this point of time, there are no discussions yet undertaken, but maybe once the assessment and the damage have been done, we will be happy to provide assistance if the Australian government confirms that there are funds available to fund the New Vanuatu workers for the reconstruction of the farm.
This is Vanuatu's Labor Commissioner Muriel Meltenhoven speaking to me earlier, and we'll keep you posted on developments there for those Vanuatu workers and other workers from around the Pacific who are here in Australia at the moment. You're listening to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this morning. Turning it to Fiji now, where alarm bells are being rung about a black sand mining project there that critics say has taken place without proper community input. And activists have linked the controversial practice that involves dredging of sand that has high mineral content to environmental and marine life damage in the region. On top of that, a recent workshop in a village bordering the mining site that was held and sponsored by the Australian-based mining company doing this work, as well as the international environment NGO, WWF, has come under fire because it's being described by some as an attempt to pacify the local landowners in regards to this mining project. Our reporter Priyanka Srinivasan has the story.
Fiji's new black sand mining project, the first in the Pacific, has been called world-class by its Australian-based owners, Amex Resources. But it has also brought controversy. The practice, sometimes called iron sand mining, involves digging up seabeds that are rich in minerals. After the iron is extracted, the sand is then returned to the ocean floor. Some human rights organisations are worried the Fiji Bar Delta project doesn't have community approval.
That is a critical area because that is a food table for this area.
Tevita Naikasualu is a Fijian activist and volunteer for the Commission of Social and Ecological Justice.
The ecosystem there is diverse and it's biodiversity, so what we are concerned about.
Mr. Naikasualu is also raising concerns over a recent coastal fisheries workshop held at Vatua, one of the villages close to the mining site. The December workshop was hosted by the Pacific arm of the international organization World Wildlife Fund in collaboration with mining company Amex and Fiji government officials. Mr. Naikasualu says locals are confused about the potential impacts of black sand mining, and the collaboration between WWF, the government and the mining company is only further muddying the issue.
I think the processes that they use to inform the people, it's not clear.
Emil Muller is chairman of the Catholic Relief Agency Caritas Group in Bar, and he also raised concerns about the workshop.
I think it is strange because WWF is supposed to be the one taking care of the people and giving them the correct information of what the effects of this mining is going to be. I think they're not doing that.
WWF Pacific told Pacific Beat that Amex was only included as a stakeholder during the workshop. It also said it couldn't comment on why it had decided to work with the company, since mining had already begun before WWF's involvement in the area. Pacific Beat reached out to local residents in Bar, but they declined to speak on the record. But in the past, community members have shared the concerns openly. In a 2019 documentary produced by Caritas, Simone Navarra, a local village leader, says communities were caught off guard by the mining.
They came to tell us that they would explore our waters to look for minerals that are in our fishing grounds. There was no clear understanding that extraction work would also take place.
Amex Resources Managing Director, Matthew Collard, has said the company's recent visit was the latest in a series of community consultations beginning in 2008. He says the company has taken all of the needed environmental impact assessments and followed all government guidelines. But some international groups continue to ring alarm bells over black sand mining in Fiji. Amy Sinclair from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre co-authored a report on the mine with local activists.
We are hearing anecdotally that it is having an impact on, for example, local crab populations in the rivers where villagers fish for their own personal use, but also to take to market. So that is a that's a relatively new development that we're watching very closely.
And for local Emil Mula back on Bar, the aim is not to stop black sand mining, but to ensure local communities can decide independently on its future.
We are not against them doing the mining, but we would like them to keep the villages, give them the information for them to understand truly what is happening.
Emil Mula ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. And Pacific Beat has also sought comment from Fiji's Mineral Resources Department on this story, and we're still to get a response. The Pacific allies of Taiwan have congratulated its president Tsai Ing-wen after she claimed around 57% of the vote in the weekend's election. President Tsai secured her second term in office after largely campaigning against unification with China. That was in stark contrast to her KMT party opponent's very pro-China stance. Now, of course, Taiwan is currently self-governing, but China considers it to be part of its sovereign territory. Globally, 15 nations retain diplomatic ties with Taiwan rather than China. And now just four of them are actually in the Pacific after the Solomon Islands and Kiribati made the switch from Taiwan to China last year. And so our reporter Nick Fogarty has been taking a look at the reaction from the Pacific and the implications for the region. Nick, what is such a resounding victory for the president's Democratic Progressive Party likely to mean for the relationships this year between Taiwan, China and Pacific countries?
Well, it is a resounding victory, as you say, with Tsai winning more than 8 million votes out of 14 million, which is the most by any presidential candidate since Taiwan began direct elections for president in 1996. And it comes after an election campaign period where China actually stepped up their pressure on Taiwan to unify with them through cutting off dialogue, halting travel of Chinese tourists to Taiwan and trying to persuade Taiwan's partners to switch allegiance. Of Taiwan's remaining Pacific partners since the election, we've seen very supportive tweets from Palau's President Tommy Ramengasau Jr. and the outgoing Marshall Islands President Hilda Heine. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, Taiwan's embassy in Palau's capital hosted an event to celebrate 20 years of diplomatic ties between the two. And here's some of what President Ramengasau had to say in a speech there.
From its position of relative size and prosperity, Taiwan has been a generous big brother throughout the region. In Palau, as in many other small island states, Taiwan has been a strong, reliable development partner. Through education, food security, infrastructure development, and healthcare assistance, the people of Taiwan have worked alongside the people of Palau for 20 years.
It is Palau's President Tommy Ramengasau Jr. speaking there earlier this month. Now, Nick, Beijing has already criticised leaders from countries that include the US, Britain and Japan after they sent their messages of congratulations to President Tsai. So how do we think they're likely to react, or China's likely to react to those countries like Palau and Marshall Islands that remain very close to Taiwan?
Well, for some more analysis on that, I spoke to the Lowy Institute's Pacific Program Director, Jonathan Pryke, and he started by telling me that if the KMT party had won the election, China might have actually released their pressure on those nations.
Now that that hasn't happened, that we have a continuation of government, it seems likely that China will maintain its pressure on Taiwan's remaining allies around the world to swap their diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to mainland China. Now, in the Pacific, I think China has had a big 2019, had big wins by securing the swaps of both Solomon Islands and Kiribati, the two largest countries that still had diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Now, the remaining four nations, Nauru, Tuvalu, Palau and Marshall Islands, are all much smaller, and personality politics is really a big driver in these countries. And for Palau and Marshall Islands, there is also the calculation of their compact relationship with the United States. They have a very unique and close relationship with the US. And the US has become much more focused and interested on Taiwan maintaining what remaining diplomatic allies it has. And so I would imagine the US will be putting a lot of pressure on those countries to remain supporting Taiwan into the future.
What sort of feeling do you think the leaders of those Pacific countries would have had if the Nationalist Party had won the election?
Honestly, I don't think that it would have changed the perception overnight between either party. It would be interesting to see how the nature of diplomacy would change, how Taiwan would change its engagement with these nations. The Tsai government has been pretty clear that they want to maintain diplomatic relations with these countries, and they are willing to keep spending money to maintain these relationships. But a lot of people in Taiwan do also have a resentment towards maintaining this diplomatic network. They don't really see a lot of utility in it, and you know, see the money that they spend in these relationships as not being the best use of resources. So what would have been interesting is how Taiwan would have changed its approach, but it seems like we're going to have a continuation of maintaining these diplomatic alliances.
Thoughts of Jonathan Pryke, the Lowy Institute's Pacific Program Director, speaking there with Nick Fogarty. Well, the momentum is building for the PNG Hunters rugby league team ahead of the new Queensland Cup season this year. But for the first time since the club was launched 6 years ago, Michael Murram is no longer in charge. The coach who led the Hunters to a premiership 3 years ago has decided to step aside to focus on coaching PNG's national team, the Kumuls, instead. And so in his place at the Hunters now is Matt Church, an Australian who was most recently an assistant coach with rivals, the Sunshine Coast Falcons, who actually finished top of the Queensland Cup ladder last year. And so Church is now putting plenty of effort into soaking up the culture of the Hunters as he gets to know his new players, as Richard Hewitt reports.
The new man at the helm with the Hunters has a hard act to follow. Michael Murram has been synonymous with the team since they were formed in December 2013. Under him, the Hunters' own unique culture was developed, living and training in camp together. And it's that culture and the countries which Matt Church will need to embrace if he's to get the team back on the winning path.
We're the only team that's professional or full-time. We're also the only team that every player is from the same country. So there's stuff around that that we can harness and drive towards that. I'm enjoying learning the cultures. And I've been out to the CEO's village and I'm getting out and about and understanding where the boys come from. And it gives you more awareness of how they have turned out as men. So I'm enjoying it.
And as part of getting to grips with PNG culture, Matt Church took time out with his players late last week to pay his respects to Joyce Otteo on the second anniversary of her son Kato's sudden death. He was training with his former Hunters teammates when he collapsed and never recovered. For senior players like Stanton Albert, part of their role is to help their new coach settle in an unfamiliar environment, while another is to help the new talent that has come into the squad from the local PNG competition to find their feet.
Yeah, I can see a lot of young boys. Like I watch them on Diesel Cup, a few boys, they're good. So they're in the camp. I'm happy with them to be part of the 2018-20 season. So it's a big challenge for me, like me and the other old boys. It's a big challenge for us to take the lead, to you know, step up and lead the boys.
Taking on PNG culture is just one part of the task facing Matt Church. There is also the question of language and how best to communicate with his players.
Most rugby league teams invent their own language anyway, the way that they talk and they speak. It might be English or it might be pidgin and you can understand it, but you have no idea what it means. So we'll write our own language and we'll get along well. We're bonding reasonably well. I'm pretty happy with how I'm getting along with the group.
One area where Church has pledged to follow in Michael Marum's footsteps is on discipline. Marum was never afraid to cut players who didn't match the standards he set in the Hunters' camp, and the new coach doesn't intend to be any different.
I'd heard through the coaching staff that there was a few people moved on for discipline issues, and I'm very much the same. I'm a person that lives by the motto that you'll act your way into the team and you'll act your way out of it. So they'll be made very aware of their responsibilities and the accountability that they'll have, especially if they've got strikes against their name. So we'll be pressing that not only just to them individuals but as a group, because there's a lot of people in PNG that would love to be wearing the Hunters gear. So there's someone else ready to take their place, and we've had to send 11 away before Christmas that would love to be back in camp so we can easily replace people.
The 2019 season, the Hunters' sixth in the Queensland Cup competition, was their poorest. They managed just 4 wins and finished second bottom of the ladder. But Matt Church has plans for a revival in 2020, and he says because of the club's setup, the Hunters need to make the most of the advantage they have over the other teams when it comes to pre-season preparation.
We're fortunate enough to be doing 9 sessions a week in the pre-season. Our other Queensland Cup clubs are going to go to work during the day and do train at night, so they're only probably doing four to five max. We're a few sessions each a week ahead of them. So as long as we can get everyone fit and healthy and making sure they're looking after their body, then when they turn up to training, we should be able to see some advance.
And the new Queensland Cup season kicks off in mid-March, and Matt Church's first Queensland Cup match in charge of the Hunters will be in Brisbane against the South's Logan Magpies.
It is Richard Hewitt reporting there, and that story was produced with the help of Melvin Lovongo, who is in Port Moresby. That is all for Pacific Beat this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for your company. You have a great day.